Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. The standard two segments up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from the economist Min-Chi Lee about what the slowdown in Chinese economic growth means. And then towards the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from George Ciccarella Marr, author of a new book, We Created Him, A People's History of the Bolivarian Revolution, on the emergence of Hugo Chavez from and his relationship to popular movements in Venezuela. Time is tight, so right on to our first guest. Min-Chi Lee teaches economics at the University of Utah. While still in China, he was arrested in 1990 for advocating free market principles. While in prison, he read Marx and Mao and rethought those principles. He emerged a Marxist in 1992. He came to the U.S. a couple of years later, entering the economics graduate program at the University of Massachusetts. He's associated with the Chinese New Left, about which we'll hear some in the following interview. The other day, the Chinese Statistical Office reported that GDP rose 7.7% in the first quarter of 2013. That's about four times U.S. growth rates, but by Chinese standards, it's rather slow. Over the last 30 years, Chinese growth has averaged just over 10% a year, the most remarkable streak in economic history, about four times the long-term U.S. average. What, if anything, does this mean? Is Chinese growth slipping down to more normal levels? Is the country making some sort of transition, or is it on the verge of some sort of crisis? Here's Min-Chi Lee to offer some thoughts. Thank you for joining us. So we learned the other day that Chinese growth has slowed to under 8% in the most recent quarter, which by Chinese standards is slowing to a crawl. What do you make of this slowdown?
That's correct. As you said, it's by the Chinese standard and by the international standard. Of course, 7.7% growth rate, that's still quite respectable. Although there's an interesting piece of data which says during the first quarter of this year, the electricity generation grew at a rate of 2.9%, which is much lower than the official growth rate for the overall economy. So that might suggest the underlying weakness is somewhat more pronounced than the official number.
How much faith should we put in, well, in any country's economic statistics, one always has to take with a grain of salt, but are the Chinese statistics reliable?
Oh, that's an interesting question. That is the China's official growth rate, and that's also the growth rate that is now generally accepted by mainstream institutions, IMF, World Bank. And so it's a number that economists typically work with.
In any case, regardless of the exact numbers, it's clear that Chinese growth has slowed perhaps significantly from the breakneck pace of the past couple of decades. Is this a symptom of a crisis or a transition or both? What's the underlying dynamic that you see?
Although, as you said, China's growth clearly has slowed down, and I don't see an immediate major crisis. And so despite the slowdown and despite some concern about especially the real estate sector, I think within short run, it should be within the capacity of the Chinese government to deal with any significant slowdown of the Chinese economy. But in the medium term, I think the Chinese economy has major concerns, including the macroeconomic imbalances, the growing pollution concern, also the potential shortage of labor supply.
Okay, let's talk about some of those things. What kind of macroeconomic imbalances are you talking about?
Well, people have been talking about is China's excessive dependence on investment, and which is now about 50% of GDP, and no other country has such a high level investment historically. And if this kind of high level investment persists, and then in the medium term, it will lead to dramatically lower capital productivity, and which, by my own estimate, potentially could lead to a major economic crisis beyond about 2020.
50% of GDP is an enormous number. I mean, it's like 10 times what we've seen in other rapidly rising countries. Where is all this investment going? What sectors, what kinds of physical investment is going on?
About 20% right now is committed to the real estate sector. And then in the other part of investment, much of that goes to infrastructure, and obviously a substantial part goes to industrial capacity. So one major concern would be whether that would build up overcapacity in the industrial sector.
Oh, and then, you know, this sounds like the groundwork for a classic realization crisis. You've got all this capital equipment. Who's going to buy all the stuff that these factories can produce?
I think so, yes. And especially if China could not increase the level of consumption and by redistributing income from the capitalists to the workers in the next few years.
Well, there are some optimistic interpretations of this growth slowdown that this is either part of or will force the Chinese into a shift from export-driven to domestically-driven economic growth. Is that possible? Is that underway?
Well, you know, the Chinese leadership has been talking about this restructuring for quite a while, but there has been no material change, especially in terms of meaningful income redistribution. Instead, the new leadership now is pursuing the policy of, on the one hand, they call it urbanization, which in effect will involve probably further steps in the privatization of land in the rural areas. And on the other hand, they have undertaken a step to privatize the railways. And so they continue to pursue the policy of neoliberal privatization that they have been something they have been done for some years.
But on the other hand, the Chinese state has been very much in control of the economic processes of the last couple of decades. Is there a risk that they, by privatizing and neoliberalizing, they're going to lose that control, and who knows what would happen then?
Well, on the one hand, I think the degree of control by the Chinese state may have been exaggerated by the mainstream media. And on the other hand, I think if they continue to pursue this policy, that would indeed undermine the effectiveness of future government regulation of the economy and therefore lay down the seeds for the future crisis.
Now, also this kind of investment, investment of 50% of GDP, how has that been financed? Has it been through internal funds of corporate profits, through borrowing, domestic borrowing, foreign borrowing? What kind of financial structures is this level of investment leave behind?
Well, I think most of that right now is still being financed by the corporate profits, and although a large portion of that, it seems to be a growing portion of that, has been financed by the debt, by the growth of credits. And there is no consistent data on the level of overall debt in the Chinese economy. But by some estimate, there's some recent study, I think, by Fitch, that suggests the credit to GDP level, the overall credit to GDP level may have risen to something like 200%. But that has to do with the it's not clear what sectors are included, and it may have included the corporate sector, the household sector, financial sector. So by that number, as far as the number itself is concerned, I would not predict an immediate debt crisis.
But that's a very large number. If there's anything like 200% of GDP, that is, you know, sort of like Japanese bubble territory of the late 80s.
Yeah, but if you add up all the debt, say the U.S. government, household, corporate sector, add up all of that debt, I suspect for the U.S. you can get a similar number.
Now, people who are bearish on the Chinese economy would argue that there is a lot of danger in the real estate sector and in the banks that have been financing the real estate sector. Do you think there's anything to that?
Well, I cannot rule out the possibility of certain collapse of investment. But first of all, I don't think it's likely. And secondly, if it does happen, and then at least in the next few years, it should be within the Chinese government's capacity to offset that with further programs of public investment. And that could hold up the growth rate to, let's say, somewhere above 5% or 6%. And so in that sense, I don't expect a major crisis to happen in the next few years. But I do think in 5 to 10 years, it will be very difficult for China to avoid a major crisis.
Based on what? How this crisis emerge?
On the one hand, I think if this current investment ratio persists, and then given reasonable economic growth rate, the capital productivity will decline to a dangerous level. And I think it will decline to a level that is comparable to the U.S. levels when historically the U.S. economy was in major crisis. And then secondly, in 5 to 10 years, China's environmental and energy crisis will basically get out of control. And then moreover, I do think that we start to see the beginning of growing working class militancy among the Chinese workers. And that potentially could challenge the Chinese capitalist income system.
Yeah, let's talk about some of those things. You said earlier that there's a risk of a labor shortage. On the other hand, you also hear that if Chinese growth rates slow, they won't be able to absorb all the population in productive labor. Which is it?
Well, I don't think I mentioned about the absorption of the surplus labor. But in any case, the China's working age population started to decline last year. And then, so historically, the Chinese capitalists have been able to benefit from this intensive exploitation of China's cheap labor force. But now this large cheap labor force starts to be depleted. And as a consequence, the wage growth has indeed accelerated, although it has not yet caught up. It has not yet caught up with the productivity growth. But in the coming years, and we may start to see further demands from the workers in terms of the demands for greater economic, political, social rights. And I don't think the Chinese capitalist system is able to accommodate those demands.
I'm speaking with Min-Chi Lee, who's an associate professor of economics at the University of Utah. Has China succeeded at all in moving out of low-wage labor and up the value chain, as they say in business?
Well, I don't think so. And in terms of international division of labor, I think China now specializes in, of course, a broad range from the low end to the intermediate end in terms of the international commodity chains. But China continues to depend on the very high-tech capital equipment imported from Germany, Japan, and U.S., and of course, China will continue to depend on the foreign import of energy and raw materials.
And then the ecological crisis is very, very serious. Filthy rivers, filthy air, and of course, China is a major contributor of greenhouse gases, perhaps the largest in the world. What kind of effects is that having on life, not just economic life, but on human life in China?
Well, in terms of the immediate impact, and some of the latest studies suggest air pollution alone is causing about 1.2 million premature deaths every year. And some other studies suggest that about 200 million people get sick every year because of drinking polluted water. And then in terms of the land pollution, it's reported that about 10% of China's arable land is polluted by some kind of heavy metals. And as a result, maybe one-sixth or one-quarter of the rice on the market is to some extent polluted by the heavy metals. So the human cost is enormous.
And is there any kind of popular environmental movement developing to address these issues?
I don't think you can talk about popular environmental movement yet, but in recent years, and you might know about this so-called mass incident in China, and which refers to incidents where people in various places, in some cases, it would involve very large-scale mass gathering, and to protest against either capitalist or local governments. And then many of these mass incidents are related to environmental concerns.
And they're also related to labor concerns, right?
Yes.
What kind of labor activism do we see in China now?
Oh, well, that's another interesting question. And because in terms of China's workers' activities, you want to talk about two different kinds. One has to do with the historical state sector, and where the state sector workers would fight against privatization and fight for their own interests and rights. And on the other hand, we also have the new working class movement that is based on the new capitalist sector, and which is more similar to what typically happens in a capitalist country.
What kind of demands are they making, and how are they making them?
Well, that's similar to what is commonly the case in the capitalist economy. So the workers at this stage would focus on the demand on higher wage, better living standards, better conditions at workplace, and so in terms of their economic interests.
Now, it's often said that the Chinese government is very nervous about social and political stability in the face of the vast social polarization, economic polarization that's occurred during these periods of rapid growth. How serious are these? Are they about in their worries about this? And actually, how serious are they in thinking of doing anything about it?
I think they are very seriously concerned about that. And in fact, we know that there was this major political turmoil last year in China that had to do with the removal of Bo Xilai from the party secretary of Chongqing, and the impact of that turmoil has continued until today. And so we know that Bo Xilai attempted a moderate reform program in Chongqing, partly in response to this growing social resentment. But apparently he was not liked by the majority of the leadership. And in fact, his reform policy might have undermine the interests of some powerful elements in the party and in the government.
How important is China's communist history in current popular thinking? I mean, do people have still some sense that this is a country that had been devoted to an egalitarian social mission, and this affects the way the working class sees the way things should be? I mean, does this have any kind of lingering ideological political effect?
I do think it is very important, and in fact, in today's Chinese ideological context, there is this growing division, a growing conflict between the so-called New Left that have to do with the intellectuals and the social activists that, to different degree, respect China's revolutionary legacy. And then, so we have this division between the New Left and then the liberals. On the other hand, the liberals basically accept the new liberal economic policy, although they also claim they aspire to have a multi-party democratic system.
What kind of larger social forces line up behind these two, or is this just a movement of elites?
Well, the social forces line up against the behind the elites.
Is there any kind of broad popular support for this either agenda, either, you know, a liberal move towards a multi-party democracy, or, you know, a new left view that looks to a new Maoism?
Right. Well, in terms of the social forces, for now, the social forces that are politically and intellectually active are still mainly limited to the urban middle class. So the, you know, the professionals, university professors, lawyers, university college students.
Now, in Western caricature, China is, you know, a very closed authoritarian state, police state with lots of censorship and repression of any kind of autonomous political activity. How does that relate to reality?
That may not be too accurate a description of reality. And in fact, of certainly, I don't want to discount that. Certainly, the political repression, persecution continue. But in practical terms, there's a lot of space for people to talk about their political opinions and debate about political issues. And although the fact of the matter is that right now much of China's mainstream is controlled by the right-wing liberals. And so by comparison, and I would say the political space available for the right-wing liberals is maybe one order of magnitude greater than that is available for the left. In fact, one of the leading leftist websites, Wuyou Zhixiang, or Utopian, was shut down by the government last year because of its support of Bo Xilai. But on the other hand, many of the well-known leading right-wing media or website continue to publish.
What effects, if any, has the global economic crisis had on China? Or has China been able to pretty much go on its own without suffering too much fallout from the financial and economic shenanigans of the last 4 or 5 years?
But before the global economic crisis, of course, the Chinese economy depended heavily on the expansion of exports. So one of the major impacts would be with this economic crisis continuing in Europe, and then with the U.S. still in economic stagnation. And so China's export market has been seriously affected. So that would imply a slowdown of China's export growth in the coming years. And then, on the other hand, if China continues to depend on imports of foreign capital goods, foreign technology, foreign energy and raw materials, and some years from now, we could see a reversal of China's trade balance from surplus to deficit.
And you know, finally, there are a lot of people who say that the 21st century is China's, that it will surpass the United States as an economic and eventually a political power. Are people getting carried away with Chinese growth, or is this something like reality you see a couple of decades ahead?
Well, maybe a little bit carried away. I do think that China will soon overtake the U.S. to become the world's largest economy measured by the purchasing power parity. But I don't think that China could match the U.S. in terms of the overall military, financial, and the geopolitical power in its ability to regulate the global capitalist system. And then, on the other hand, the U.S. itself is in decline in the sense that it has less and less capacity to regulate the global capitalist system for the system's own long-term common interest. And so that might mean that the various contradictions and the conflicts in the whole system will continue to intensify in the coming years or in the coming decades, as we have already seen, you know, in the development in the Middle East.
And do the Chinese elites have any aspiration to be that kind of global or regional hegemon?
It depends. There are some sections of China's elites, especially in the military, and may have that kind of expectation. But I think they are a minority in the Chinese leadership. The basic thinking of the current Chinese leadership is to become, they hope, to become a so-called responsible power within a U.S.-led system.
That was Min-Chi Lee, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Utah. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
A robin's got a spin. Koresh was in designer. May my strength is dust and liner. Heidi Nail and inside.
That was some of Eel Sang from a new album by Wire. Yes, a new album from Wire. Next up is George Ciccarello Marr, who teaches political science at Drexel. His book, We Created Him, A People's History of the Bolivarian Revolution, which is about the emergence of Hugo Chavez from and his relationships to popular movements in Venezuela, is just out from Duke University Press. George was on the show just after Chavez died, but his book wasn't out yet, so I wanted to have him back to discuss it once it was available. Among many things, it's a fascinating study of how state and popular movements can coexist in productive tension. It's a call to junk the unproductive opposition of top-down and bottom-up in favor of a more dialectical view. George Ciccarello Marr. Welcome, George. Congratulations on a fine book, and also rather well-timed. Any thoughts, first of all, on the election results from this past weekend?
Well, I mean, there are a million things to say about this Venezuelan election. Firstly, that it was astonishingly close. I think no one really expected this result to be so tight. Certainly the Chavistas did not, but even the opposition didn't. And it's partly because the polls that were coming out in the run-up to the election, I believe, were accurate. They were showing Maduro up by 12%, even more occasionally. And then something happened in the last week or so that still needs to be analyzed and understood, and led to a very, very tight result where Maduro won by just about 1.6%. Now, the other thing to say is that Maduro did win. There's no question about these elections. These are the best observed and most highly audited and most bulletproof elections on earth, essentially, and the Carter Center has even said this. So there's no question about the outcome, but the Venezuelan opposition is currently attempting to use the close outcome. It's gotten them very excited, and they're attempting to use it as leverage for who knows what. You know, they're calling for a full recount, and according to, you know, some people there, they're attempting to lay the ground for a future coup.
Okay, so let's start talking about your book. You start your book essentially in, although there are certainly fragments before this, but basically in 1958. What happened then and why?
Well, this is kind of paradoxical as well, right? Because the book that tells the story of the Bolivarian Revolution from below, from the struggles of the people, begins in 1958. I chose to begin in 1958. And what's strange about that is that 1958 is the year in which formal democracy, representative democracy, was established in Venezuela. And that's very important because it reminds us that a lot of what's going on in Venezuela today in the so-called Bolivarian Revolution is not a struggle for representative democracy. It's been historically a struggle against certain aspects of representative democracy, and particularly the form of representative democracy that existed in Venezuela for 40 years, which was a two-party system, largely, in which these two predominant parties channeled all dissent into very structured organizations, all subsumed to the parties, so that if you fell outside of that, or if you weren't being represented, you had very little chance of having your voice actually heard. And so what's kind of astonishing is that democracy is established in 1958, and by 1960, there's a guerrilla struggle. And that's a very, you know, quick transition from celebrating the establishment of democracy to realizing its limitations. And in that sense, the guerrillas were a vanguard sector to a fault, in the sense that they didn't realize in some ways that it's going to be very hard to convince a population that was still excited about democracy that they needed to pick up arms against that democracy. But they were foresight. They had a great amount of foresight in the sense that they did foresee what was going to be coming down the pipe. And in many ways, they foresaw it because they were already getting attacked by the government. By 1960, there was a state of emergency. You know, demonstrating workers and students and campesinos were attacked and shot. And so you had this very repressive and non-representative democracy that was established.
And what was the class power at this point? Who were the Venezuelan ruling class?
Well, it's an interesting question. Venezuela is an oil country. Oil exploitation began in earnest in the 20s and 30s. And in the 20s and 30s, as a result, you have an expansion of public education to a new sort of upper middle class. And it's precisely this class, which became, a generation of students in the 1930s, that became radicalized, resisting the dictatorships that existed then, and then generated the generation that would eventually overthrow the dictatorships in 1958. But by this time, these sort of elites, these upper middle class, well-educated elites, a lot of whom had been living outside of the country, were themselves being outmaneuvered by a younger generation. And so the predominant party that overthrew the dictatorship itself split, and many of the youth of that party turned toward the guerrilla struggle against that new system. The class question is interesting in Venezuela because in such an overwhelmingly oil-driven country, the central question is not, for example, the landed oligarchy, as it is in places like Colombia or other countries. It's been more specifically the fact that oil wealth is mediated through the state, and the state itself then generates a political class. And this is the political class that became more and more impervious to the will of the masses as the 60s, 70s, and 80s moved on, and that ultimately was fully displaced in the 1990s.
All right, now back to the popular movements. The Cuban Revolution had just occurred. What sort of influence did that have on popular struggles in Venezuela?
Had a major influence in Venezuela, had a major influence throughout Latin America, because what the Cuban Revolution showed was that you didn't need to wait necessarily for the so-called objective conditions that the academic Marxists were telling you to wait for. You could go out and begin to create those conditions. And so this led to, in many ways, the split within these ruling parties, where the youth sectors joined the revolution, joined the guerrilla struggle in the 1960s, both as an inspiration, but also because that ruling party, the ostensibly social democratic party, Acción Democrática, Democratic Action, was following the U.S. mandate of essentially condemning the Cuban Revolution and the Castro regime, and becoming very increasingly critical of what he called Castro communism. And so the youth, both inspired by the Cuban Revolution and sort of turned off, there, to say the least, by their own leadership, condemning that revolution, turned more toward this sort of voluntarist approach to guerrilla warfare. Now, the problem is that the understanding of guerrilla warfare in Latin America was tainted in many ways right from the outset by the text of Régis Debray, above all, who wrote Revolution and the Revolution, attempting to sort of theorize what had happened in Cuba. But the problem was, it wasn't a very accurate theorization of even Cuba. Debray, to put it in sort of the most caricatured, basic level, Debray's argument is that small units called focos of guerrillas can, by being detached from the community and being mobile, can create objective conditions through generating a generating wave of struggle. And the problem is that this implied that it was actually almost a virtue to not be based in a community, to not be connected to the population, because Debray would say that it would be a sitting duck if that was the case. And he was critiquing heavily the early FARC, establishment of the FARC in Colombia, which had established self-defense zones with militia structures. And now, ironically, or not ironically at all, the FARC historically outlived many of the movements that Debray would be most associated with. And what happened in Venezuela is what is predictable, namely the fact that these small groups of guerrillas, often driven by romantic motivations, many university students directly straight out of the university in Caracas, although this wasn't always the case, the Communist Party militants were certainly more working class a lot of times, they engaged in a prolonged guerrilla struggle that really didn't bear much fruit at all. It was a very important struggle. It has a lot of historic legacy in Venezuela, but it was a severe miscalculation.
I'm speaking with George Ciccarello Marr, whose book, We Created Him, is just out from Duke University Press. And, were these bunch of smallish groups that were just basically freelancing?
It wasn't supposed to be that way. It began with the development of focos across the country. They were unified into what was called the Armed Forces of National Liberation, the FALN, under a leadership structure. And yet there always remained a kind of territorialism under whether it be certain leaders, certain comandantes in different parts of the country, contributing to this with their personality, but also because there were several different parties involved. The Communist Party was involved, the MIR, the Revolutionary Left Movement, which had split from Acción Democrática. So this is sort of these radicalized liberals, very imbued with the Cuban example, were involved. And then, a number of other smallish groupings from different ideological backgrounds were also involved. And so you had such divisions within the guerrilla struggle that it never became really a coherent movement. And even more so after the Communist Party withdrew from the struggle, was it the case that, that those personalities who had not essentially made the decision to withdraw remained in the mountains and started their own their own guerrilla groupings even after, in this very late era of the guerrilla struggle.
And the guerrilla struggle sort of petered out by the end of the 60s, right?
Yeah.
What then characterized the 70s?
The 70s I characterize as a sort of dispersal, a reflection on the failure of the guerrilla struggle, but many of these post-guerrilla movements dispersing themselves, whether it be in factories or in the development of new social movements, and particularly an effort to grapple with the demographic shift going on in Latin America, which, especially in Venezuela, drew hundreds of thousands, even millions of people from the countryside to the city. And so where these guerrillas, who under the influence of Debray thought that the rural struggle was primary and the urban struggle was a rearguard struggle, started to realize that the cities are really sort of where the struggle needs to be oriented, and specifically these burgeoning, growing barrios with like hundreds of thousands and millions of people. And so you began to see the development of new understandings of organization specific to the urban periphery. And specifically, referring back to Debray, you see a return to this question of local self-defense as opposed to offensive focused guerrilla struggle. And this really began to develop in the 1980s in what is called the Tupamaro phenomenon, which are these sort of revolutionary urban militias in the barrios that essentially control their own territories. They're communist, and yet they have also a very decentralizing vision, and they establish their autonomy in these neighborhoods by force, even against the old regime in the 70s and 80s.
And Venezuela never had its Pinochet, did it?
No, and that's actually a part of the particularity of this struggle that's going on in Venezuela. Not only was there no Pinochet, there was no really sustained guerrilla struggle of the kind that a lot of people would argue lead to someone like Pinochet. You didn't have the radical polarization between a super left-wing guerrilla struggle and a super right-wing military response. You had a military structure which was already historically right-wing, of course, but with progressive elements in it, with nationalist certainly elements that had participated in attempts to overthrow the government in the past from the left. And so you have definitely a different dynamic playing out in the military. And what you have is actually civilian leaders in the 70s and 80s especially, not really in association with, not generals, not high-ranking military officials, but civilian leaders giving the order to slaughter civilians to maintain a sort of civilian rule. It just looks very different than what you had in Chile.
This is the environment that Hugo Chavez was in his 20s when as this was developing. What was he up to?
Well, he was biographically he wanted to be a baseball player, but ended up taking the more slightly safer path of joining the military. And he was a middle-ranking officer and an instructor as well at the military university, the military academy. And there he was studying, of course, classics, but also studying the history of Venezuelan revolution, studying Bolivar, studying these people that the Venezuelan government would celebrate at the time, but who had within themselves a very subversive kernel. Not just Bolivar, but people like Zamora, whose slogan was hatred of the oligarchy, and would go around burning down he once burned down the land title building to free up the land. He burned down any proof that anyone owned any of the land. And so he was someone who took, radical measures and who yet is part of this Venezuelan legacy. So he was studying them, he was studying Mao, studying Che, and beginning to be radicalized. His brother was in the PRB, which was one of these late guerrilla organizations that came out of the guerrilla struggle in the mountains as well. But Chavez is in the military, and when things really fall apart, and when there is the massive 1989 Caracas Rebellion, in which the military itself is sent out to slaughter people in the barrios, killing up to 3,000, this is really sparks the imperative to also struggle within the military. They had been conspiring with the military, but it was the Caracas in 1989 that forced Chavez and others to act. And the action took the form of the 1992 coup that was the failed coup by Chavez and others.
Okay, we are leaping episodically about here, but the 1989 Caracas Rebellion, what was that about and what was its importance?
The 1989 Caracas Rebellion was prompted by, most directly by, an effort at neoliberal reform by the government of Carlos Andrés Pérez. Now, Pérez was elected in early 1989 on a platform that was essentially anti-IMF, anti-World Bank, anti-Washington consensus, and it was very critical of these international lending institutions. And yet within a month of being elected, there was this about-face, which has been called a bait-and-switch, in which the government announced that it would essentially be instituting the Washington consensus to the letter. And this meant liberalizing prices that had been restricted. It meant attempting to cut back on government spending in a whole number of ways, raise more revenue. And part of that raising of revenue was the liberalization of gas prices domestically. Gasoline to this day is incredibly cheap in Venezuela. You can fill up the tank, a tank of a car for about a dollar. And yet this price doubled overnight, meaning that people went to get on the bus on February 27th of 1989 at 5 in the morning, went to take the bus to work, and found out the bus had doubled in price. And they responded by flipping the buses over and lighting them on fire. And this spread rapidly across the country because there had been this sort of build up of economic crisis that had pushed, by this point, more than 60% of the population into poverty.
And the government's response was repression.
Yes, it was an attempt to restore normality by slaughtering as many people as was necessary. And they really don't know how many people were killed because they're still discovering mass graves with bodies in just plastic bags all over the capital.
What was the political result of this uprising and slaughter?
initially there was an effort by the political parties to rein in what was going on, in part by sacrificing the president. They essentially, you know, had him impeached and attempted, you know, to have him arrested and all these things. On the other hand, you had the leader of the other party essentially jumping ship from his own party, forming a new party, because he could really, you know, he could sense the way the wind was blowing. So he formed a new party and managed to cobble together enough votes to win the 1993 election on this basis, partly by showing his sympathy for these rebellions and his critique of the repression. This was not a permanent fix, however, because this was, at this point, the party system was in free fall. The two traditional parties were collapsing. They were essentially poison pills that if they touched anyone, you wouldn't be able to get elected. And so this was a moment of sort of vacuum of political institutions and parties. And it was into this vacuum that Chavez stepped, finally being convinced by some of his supporters, you know, including Nicolas Maduro, who's now the president of Venezuela, that that the time was right for an electoral bid, because Chavez himself was against trying to run in these elections. You know, elections were seen as the most, you know, as the part of the problem and not part of the solution.
I'm speaking with George Ciccariello Marr. His book, We Created Him, is just out from Duke University Press. He did win election, and you describe the relation of the popular movements that have been developing over the decades with Chavez regime is rather complicated. They were struggling for and against the state. It was a relationship of critical support, yet determined autonomy. What happened in the early Chavez years? What did he do, and what did the popular movements do?
What's interesting is that Chavez is elected more or less as a moderate. That's not to say that there weren't radical elements of his discourse, but when he's elected, he's talking about third way between socialism and capitalism. He's talking about taking the edge off of savage capitalism. And I mean, this is partly strategic, but at the same time, he sort of believes it at this point. Strategic in the sense that they know that the party system is collapsing. Moderate voters from the other parties are looking for anyone else to vote for. And so when Chavez is elected, he's actually very much elected by the middle class as well. He receives a vast majority of the middle class at the last minute. You know, big financial institutions withdraw their support from others to support him, because they think that this is, you know, their only way forward. And Chavez begins to institute moderate social welfare reforms with what little resources he has, because it's very difficult for the government at this point to access the oil wealth. It's sort of tucked away as a part of this sort of public but sort of private state oil company. And so what, you know, Chavez does things like he takes the military and sends them to the barrios to help eliminate, to help diagnose health problems, and to try to, deal with these fundamental questions that are prevailing in society. And at some point he begins to push these reforms a little bit. He pushes a package of reforms in 2001, which proves very controversial, but which looked at compared to what's going on today is really not that controversial. On doing this, he is attacked so severely that that Chavez himself refers, I think quite credibly, to the fact that he had thought that he could, that social democracy was an option prior to this. But this counterattack, without him actually engaging, people call it a counter-revolution without a revolution, he is attacked before he even does very much, made him realize that the ruling elites really were not going to give up much at all, and that it was sort of either revolution or just following the rule of capital. And so this is where he begins to radicalize, and it coincides as well with the rising tension in 2001 and then the coup of 2002, April 2002.
But that actually mobilized a lot of his support.
Yes, it did, and it was a Venezuelan intellectual, Roland Denis, who I think is one of the sharpest critics writing about Venezuela, has said that the Venezuelan process has had the virtue of moving from event to event. And it's sort of in the Baduian language of events as those momentary sharp ruptures which determine the possibility of what comes afterward. And 1989 is the fundamental founding event in some ways of this revolution, or of this phase of this revolution that allows Chavez to rise to power and everything. But were it not for 2002, we would have seen in some ways, or we could have seen the slow waning in the energy of the revolutionary process. But what 2002 did really was to powerfully revitalize the process, to allow it to become more radical by removing some of the more reactionary elements within the military, within the government even, and completely discrediting politically the Venezuelan opposition, so allowing the Chavistas a free hand in in pushing forward with some of these transformations. So you have a situation in which in 2006, Chavez won the election by 25%, you know, this sort of massive sweeping victory.
As we were talking when you were on the show last time, the caricature of Chavez as some sort of traditional Latin American strongman is just very much at odds with reality, right?
It is. And I mean, I think the reality is I think that caricature is one that's designed by imperialist governments to, you know, and contains a heavy dose of racism, because it essentially entails that, you know, that, you know, we're rational here in the United States and the Latin Americans vote, you know, and because of, you know, their connection to, you know, strongmen or their charismatic leadership. And I think that's so I mean, I guess I'm saying that I think it applies rarely. But Chavez, you know, certainly was not anything like this, because it was not a question of centralizing power for the centralization of power. It wasn't a question of even developing an unnecessarily personalistic attachment to an individual leader. It was always bound up with this historic process that had been developing prior to Chavez, and that will continue in the future.
Slavoj Žižek has this piece just out in which he's arguing, in his characteristically manic and sometimes ill-focused way, that political progress needs something like a strong figure like Chavez, so that that there's this complicated relationship between the popular movements and the leader, but you just can't have a pure grassroots-driven revolution. What do you think of that, and how Chavez and Chavistas fit into that?
I think we could read what's going on in Venezuela and what has happened in Venezuela as a verification of something of what Žižek is saying. Namely, this is not, you know, the idea of the multitude self-governing by itself or something like that. Not only is that, you know, does it contain political difficulties that are rarely acknowledged, but it contains a complicated question over how these things actually play out and how it is that processes become unified, you know, after the guerrilla struggle, which itself was never very unified, even though it had this sort of formal overarching structure. You had the flourishing and development of autonomous revolutionary movements. And this is powerfully important. And it's sort of this dialectical development of the movements, which allowed them to generate their strength and generate their, you know, their depth. And it was, in that sense, necessary. But by the 90s, especially after the Caracaso, and there are these flourishing autonomous neighborhood councils developing across the country, which are, you know, crucially important to what came afterward as well, you had these critics begin to emerge and saying, well, you know, this is all very good, but our sort of allergy to centralization and unification of the process is going to prevent this from moving forward. We need to struggle on a national level and forge some kind of national unity. And the way that that can emerge, I believe, can take different forms. The form that it took was the form of Chavez, because he threw himself forward in this coup, stood in front of the nation on television, taking responsibility for the failure of the coup and promising that they'd only been defeated por ahora, for now, and therefore essentially thrusting himself to the center of this struggle. Now, if he'd not decided to run in the election after that, it's possible that his centrality of this process would not have been, you know, as pronounced. But after it, you know, the strategy became one of running elections, you know, of course, there's a tendency as well for it to be more and more centered on his individual, but again, not for personalistic connection, but for the political implications that person bears. You know, Chavez, people identify, I know the way to put this is that people identify with Chavez, not because he's a charismatic leader. They identify with him because he represents the revolutionary process that they identify with. And I think it's really important to mark this distinction. And so that's part of the error, I think, with Žižek's perspective, is that it's this sort of deeply deterministic psychoanalytic account of how we need this sort of father figure to help us. And, you know, and I think there's something fundamentally dubious about the way in which he makes the argument. But on the other hand, those who say, no, we don't need any leaders, we can just do this by ourselves, are also running against the grain of the history of revolutionary movements and the way that they, the sorts of dynamics that actually draw them together and push them forward.
And we're just about out of time, but now, of course, there's been another one of those events, Chavez's death. What effect do you think this is going to have on the revolution of the last decade and a half?
I actually think, and this is getting, again, to Žižek's point, I think it would be very difficult. It's anyone's guess what's going to happen, but I think it would be very difficult to establish another figure like Chavez. In other words, Maduro is not going to be Chavez. In fact, none of the Chavistas are going to be Chavez, and so this revolution is either going to develop some other form of unity, or collective leadership or practice of you know, democracy within the PSU, the political party, or it's going to be, I think, a slow death of the process, where it moves slightly toward the center, or it gets, you know, or loses the election in 6 years, or recall in 3 years. There has to be some kind of re-energizing of this process. Now, the reality is, it's possible that that re-energizing could take the form of another coup against the Chavistas. And if the opposition is silly and foolish enough to throw themselves into another coup, and then are defeated again, then we may find whoever, heroically stood forward as the Chavista representative in defeating that coup may become another, another powerful individual leader. But absent that kind of event, my guess is that there's going to be some other kind of practice that's developed.
That was George Ciccarello Amar. He teaches political science at Drexel, and his book, We Created Him, A People's History of the Bolivarian Revolution, is just out from Duke University Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this. More from the new Wire album, This Attractive Space. Till next week, bye.
Consequences of many underwriters. Black glasses falling, the price inflated.